Jen Gers has few memories of her father. She was only 12 when he disappeared.
He had a mole above his left or right eye. I don't even know which it was, but I remember I used to look at his face and I'd always look at that. But I guess that's not even a memory, you know. Mum and Dad separated when I was 3, so our contact with him was sporadic. I don't even remember the last thing I said to him or when I last saw him. I do remember we tried to call him on Boxing Day, but he'd already left for the start of the race. He'd already gone.
David John Campbell Graham was passionate about sailing. In the early 80s, he was in the Navy and the family lived at HMAS Cerberus Naval Base in Victoria. He started sailing on the yachts the Navy had.
I've got quite a lot of the pennants, you know, the little triangle flags that he had from the Navy. I think his first Sydney to Hobart was 1988, because I have a photo of him with a bunch of very 80s looking guys in short shorts and tight shirts. It's written on the back, Sydney to Hobart, 1988.
In 1994, David finished the Sydney to Hobart yacht race for his second time on a yacht called Impetuous. It was on the journey home in early January 1995 that he went missing.
They made it to Hobart, but on delivery, when they transport back to where they came from, he was washed overboard. There's these rails that go down the side of the boat. They're called jack lines. He'd unclipped his harness from the rear to move down to the front of the boat. And at the same split second, they were hit by a wave. If it had been daylight, he would have seen that wave coming and waited to unclip. But it was pitch black. He just didn't see it.
The coordinates placed Impetuous around the New South Wales-Victoria border, equivalent to the south coast town of Eden on land. It was 3 a.m. on January 7th, 7 weeks before David's 40th birthday. An extensive search commenced and continued for 2 days, but his body was never found. It's difficult to commemorate a person when they're lost in the ocean, and Jen has never been to the site where her father was swept overboard.
We don't have a headstone. We have a police report with coordinates. One day I think we'll go to Eden and maybe take a boat out to the area and have time with him where he last was.
On the 20th anniversary of his disappearance, they organised for a returning Sydney to Hobart yacht passing the location to put a wreath out to sea, a tribute from them to him. But there was another family tragedy the year before that anniversary. Andrew Sinclair Graham was David's brother and Jen's uncle. Almost 2 decades after David disappeared, Jen received the news that Andrew too had vanished.
There's a hole in my heart the size of an island. There's a hole in my heart the size of an island. Islands can be big and small.
Christmas Island is an Australian territory that lies in the Indian Ocean, roughly 2,700 kilometres northwest of Perth. It's a tropical island covered with thick rainforest and edged with steep cliffs. Home to just 1,800 permanent residents, these days it's best known for its refugee and immigration detention centre. In 2011, Jen's uncle, Andrew Graham, started working for Davidson Trehearne Corpsych, a company that provides employee assistance programs and corporate psychology services. One of their offerings is an employee assistance program for Australian immigration officials who work at the detention centres on Christmas Island. It's a fly-in, fly-out program, which involves a single worker being deployed to the island for 1 month at a time on a rotating basis. In 2012, Andrew applied to join and was accepted. On Tuesday, September 30, 2014, Andrew had just completed one of his month-long rotations on the island. He was scheduled to go to Christmas Island Airport to meet the colleague who was about to replace him and provide a handover briefing before flying back to the Australian mainland later that same day. Yet his colleague, Rochelle Hurd, saw no sign of him. She tried calling his phone, but he didn't answer. When Rochelle decided to check his room, she saw that Andrew hadn't checked out or even packed up his belongings. She immediately went to the Christmas Island police station to report him missing. It soon emerged that Andrew had also failed to show up to work the previous day, but no one noticed his absence as it had been a public holiday for immigration staff. Police inquiries revealed that Andrew had last been seen 3 days earlier on the afternoon of Friday, September 26, at the Christmas Island Immigration Detention Centre. Some of the immigration employees had invited him to a barbecue they were holding the following morning, but he declined the invitation as he was planning a trip to Winifred Beach, a remote spot on the southwestern edge of the island. CCTV footage showed that Andrew left the detention centre at 3:32 that afternoon. Authorities quickly turned their attention to Winifred Beach. To access the remote spot, visitors have to travel down a 5-kilometre four-wheel drive vehicle track, then follow a 550-metre long walking trail. The vegetation off the marked trails is thick and extremely difficult to walk through due to an abundance of thorny vines. At the end of the trail, there's a coastal cliff with a series of steep aluminium stairs that lead to the water's edge. Phone reception in the area is patchy or non-existent. The beach itself is tiny, approximately 10 metres long by 4 metres wide. It sits 30 metres south of the staircase and can only be accessed by walking along a rock platform at the base of the cliff and through a trough. Depending on the tide, the water along the platform varies from ankle to thigh deep, while the water in the trough can be between stomach and chest height. Police soon found Andrew's work car parked 0.5 kilometre down the Winifred Beach vehicle track, making it 4.5 kilometres away from the car park and the start of the walking track. A nearby sign indicated that only four-wheel drive vehicles were permitted beyond that point. Andrew's car was locked and his phone and keys were still inside. However, one of the two snorkel masks that were usually kept in the car was missing.
Initially, they thought he might have gone into the bush. There was quite a lengthy search for him in the jungle because Christmas Island, I think, is quite dense tropical jungle. Also, Winifred Beach is, I think, quite rocky, and there's a section there that you need to wade kind of waist deep to get to the next part of the beach. But I can't say specifically because I've never physically stood on that beach.
Police undertook an extensive search of the land and sea, even obtaining a special grant to use cadaver dogs, despite dogs not typically being allowed on the island. But no sign of Andrew was found. If he'd stayed on the clearly marked path, he should have arrived safely at the staircase that led to the beach. However, if he left the path, he could have become lost in the thick jungle. Providing Andrew did make it to the staircase, he would have had to navigate the 30-metre rock platform and narrow trough to access the beach. Locals complete this journey quite often, but have sometimes been injured while doing so. Mark, a commercial fisherman who's lived and worked at Christmas Island for 20 years, also visited Winifred Beach on Saturday, September 27, and said that there was an incoming swell that was far more dangerous than usual. The swell might not have been immediately visible to someone standing on the rock platform, and they could have been taken by surprise by a large wave while crossing on foot. Andrew Graham was a qualified pool lifeguard and a strong swimmer who swam regularly on Christmas Island. But if he was suddenly struck by the swell, he might have found it hard to swim back to shore. Also, there are sharp rocks that frame the island's coastline, making it difficult for someone to safely reach land if they are swept out. An inquest was held into Andrew's disappearance with coroner Sarah Linton delivering her findings on May 25, 2016. She concluded that Andrew had somehow died due to misadventure, but was unable to determine whether he became lost in the rainforest or was washed out to sea. Andrew's family had struggled to comprehend his disappearance, especially as it followed his brother's tragic loss 20 years earlier.
Losing someone is tragic enough, but to have lightning strike twice, my grandparents in particular went through more than anyone needs to. Two children in fairly, not similar, but just horrendous circumstances. You want to know the definition of strong? It's them, for sure.
Jen's eldest daughter, Imogen, had just turned 3 at the time Andrew went missing. Explaining to her where he had gone was difficult.
"Mummy, why are you sad?" she would ask. I had to say to her in a way a 3-year-old would understand. "Uncle Andy, they can't find him." "Why can't they find him?" "I don't have an answer." "Kids always want answers from you. Why don't they just find him? Where is he? Why can't they find him?" It's such a simplistic way to view things, but it's so difficult to explain in a way that she would understand.
Jen can relate to her daughter's perspective. She still remembers her own struggle to comprehend that her father, David, wouldn't be coming back after he was swept overboard on that return sailing journey in 1995.
I remember clearly one night I was laying in bed, probably about 15, maybe 16 years old, and I just said the words out loud, "He's gone." And I just couldn't comprehend that. Your heart breaks like the first time they tell you he's gone. And with Andrew, it just brought it all back. I felt in a way it was harder. As a kid, you kind of get on with being a kid. As an adult, it's just in your face.
Even with 2 coroner's reports determining that her father and uncle had both died, Jen has never resigned herself completely to the findings.
The funny thing, when you have a missing person scenario, however likely the outcome, it's only ever in your head. Your head tells you, yep, your dad's been in the water for 48 hours, it's cold. You need to come to terms with the fact that they're not going to find him. And even when you know years later, of course they're gone, your head says that repeatedly, but your heart just never puts it to rest, ever, that that person is truly gone.
When her grandfather died, she felt blessed to bear witness.
It sounds really horrible, but I guess I was fortunate to sit by his bedside and watch him pass away. There's something definite about that, but when someone's missing, there's just this endless, ambiguous place. I used to have these dreams when I was a teenager that I was on Ricky Lake. You know that Ricky Lake show? And Ricky Lake found my dad. Someone had picked him up. A container ship picked him up. They popped him out of the water and here he is. And that was the dream. Because I never saw him. There was never a body. There was never a definite that he was dead. There was just that endless to-ing and fro-ing for years and years and years. Even now, I sometimes have that dream. The same with Andrew. Maybe he was washed out to sea. Maybe an Indonesian fishing boat picked him up. Maybe he's in Indonesia somewhere.
Jen will join me in the studio after this word from our sponsors. And now Jen joins me in the studio for a conversation about the disappearances of both her father and her uncle. So, Jen, as you're acutely aware, the ordeal for families of missing persons, the experiences that you guys have, it's generally confined to the family unit. People outside of this don't really get an insight. So that's what this podcast is for. This is the chance to elaborate on those experiences. So we're really glad that you've trusted us to come in here today and share them with us. You and I connected a few years ago, I think probably through the Facebook page, the MPAN Facebook page. What prompted you to reach out to us?
I think at the time I was getting involved in wanting to do the Sydney to Hobart. And there was an opportunity that came about for me to kind of publicise that in a way. And I thought, what better chance to get the whole story of my dad and my uncle out there, but to kind of align it with an organisation that provides support to families of missing persons. It just, the two just kind of connected for me and I thought, yeah, why not?
I'm glad you did. I'm always curious about the way that families choose to or choose not to disclose their experience of missingness in like a social setting. So can you tell me about how, particularly when you were younger, say as a young adult, and people naturally ask, you know, so what does your dad do? Did you explain that he had gone missing, which generally gets a response of, oh my gosh, super awkward, people don't know what to say? Or did you say, you know, he's passed away, which is a much, I guess, more natural and therefore simpler concept for people to grasp with and sympathize with? What did you tend to say in those situations?
I think because as a kid, I don't ever remember, like I remember the search, I remember that aspect, but it was always he had died. So for me as a child, I don't know why, but I don't think I ever made the connection as a child that this whole missingness type scenario. It was always people would ask me, or, you know, about my dad, oh, he died. Or then I would elaborate and say he was lost at sea the older I got. So I think as I got older, it kind of progressed to, well, no, he's missing. He's coroner's found a finding, but they never found him. And I think the older I've got, the more I've made the connection to that. But yeah, definitely as a child, it was always, well, my dad had died.
I think that's fair enough, because it is a very complicated type of grief. It's unresolved, so people can't really understand it. There are no customs and rituals like there are with traditional bereavement where the loss is clear. So I think especially for a young person, a child in particular, it is too much to comprehend.
Yeah, for sure. And I think in some ways it was just far easier to say, well, my dad died, rather than he went missing, because, yeah, how do you explain that?
Exactly. And when you do, nowadays, I don't know how you found it, but when you tell people that your dad and your uncle are missing and the response is awkward, people struggle to respond to death, let alone an unresolved loss like a missing person. So have you found that, are you conscious of people being made uncomfortable when you share that?
Oh, definitely. Because I think, yeah, you know, if it happens once, that in itself is horrendous. It's overwhelming. But then to explain, oh, my uncle's, you know, went missing too, and I think I've gotten used to that look. Like, what? How on earth? And then that always leads into a conversation about what happened and all the rest of it. And I think as time has progressed from me as a child, 1995, to me as an adult, 2014, I think it is a different environment. I think we have come part of the way, but not all the way, you know. I noticed that difference having dealt with missing persons as a child and missing persons as an adult. It's hard. I mean, it's a hard conversation to have. It's an even harder conversation to have twice.
I can't even imagine. And for your grandparents, both of their sons, they're only children, they're only two children. For them both to have gone missing is just beyond comprehension. How did they manage that? I mean, it's the first time it happens, it's hard enough. And then to go through it again, and that generation in particular, I think, is, you know, they're built tough, they are resilient. Did they share that with the people around them, or was that sort of like a private thing for them? How did they cope?
I think more than anything, maybe drew them in a bit, inwards a bit more. I mean, I don't know. They're strong Scottish people. My grandmother in particular lives in a country town. So, you know, I think she has a lot of support in the older country women around her, which is glorious. I love that. But if anything, I think when Andrew went missing, I guess there's no other way to sort of say it, but I mean, I think it probably aged them a lot more. And having been down that road before, I think they were very resigned to the fact that while you can try and hold out hope, when you've already heard that tune before, you kind of have this expectation of what the outcome will be. And I think that is one thing that I remember, is that I feel like Grandma was very, very resigned to the result very early on. And I don't know if that's just from Dad's experience, where you have hope for a very long time, but, you know, when Andrew happened, maybe she didn't have enough hope left to hold out for a good result for him. So I do remember that. I do remember her being, I don't know if accepting is the right word, but I don't know. I think she didn't put up a fight about it. She wasn't vocal about it. She didn't put up posters. She didn't make a Facebook page. You know, all the things you do with hope, it drives you. But I think with Grandpa and Grandma, maybe they'd just given up hope 20 years ago.
I think that's understandable. I mean, most people, when this happens once, let alone twice, are overwhelmed by that sense of hopelessness and helplessness. And I think when your dad disappeared and the way in which that happened, I mean, it's out in the ocean. Like, that's gigantic. It makes it even harder. And 20 years ago, so there, you know, there wasn't social media. It was so much harder in many regards. So you can completely understand why they would feel that way. And then to be in the situation where it happens again, I mean, it's just uncanny. I found that when my brother was missing, Mum in particular would, and I did it too, but I remember her saying, at least we know he's in Australia. There's this kind of strange, I think it's quite natural when you're in a unique situation to want to compare, as if it kind of is comforting to know that it could be worse. So Mum would say things like, oh, at least we know he's in Australia, in reference to another case where a woman, like from a similar, you know, situation, her son was missing overseas. He was missing in Canada. And Mum said, like, you know, it's impossible to all that way away and, you know, the distance. And that same family whose son and brother was missing in Canada said, for us, you know, at least it's so far away. We can't spend every weekend searching. There is that distance, so it's easier for us. So it's just really interesting how people interpret their own scenario in comparison to someone else who's sort of in a similar predicament. Did you ever find that with your dad, because people were there with him, they were witnesses, because it was an accident and that was a fact, because there were people there that could prove that, and that it was therefore less likely that he was alive, so people would assume that, you know, there's a bit more resolve there. Do you then compare that to other types of situations? I mean, you've got another one in your own family, which is unbelievable.
For sure. I feel like I often think to myself, oh, well, he's lost at sea. Is that the same thing? Yeah, I often do feel that way. I often do have those thoughts that, you know, people go missing every day under so many different circumstances. Is being lost at sea the same thing? And I honestly think it's the same type of grief. It's the same type of what if. There's no answers. You have answers to a point. Well, he was washed overboard. No one saw him from there. Okay, but what about after that? And the whole Ricky Lake scenario, what if he got picked up? Who knows? And that's where your mind plays games with you forever about, well, there's no body, so how do you know? And I think in that way, it's the same as every missing person case that ever was and ever will be. There's no end. How can you simply put to rest a person, a thing, when you have no physical evidence, I guess, maybe one of a better word, that they actually died. However likely the scenario, and I've rationalised that always, and you always do, same with Andrew. But again, you know, until you have that body, those remains, or someone that says, yep, this is what happened because I saw it, or something like that, how do you ever really know? And I think that is where missing persons, families of missing persons, will always find themselves. And some people may have a better ability to accept the likelihood of what happened or whatever the case may be, and to move on, maybe. But I think there may be families of missing persons out there that think there is no end. How can you?
Until there is that proof.
Yeah.
You continue to hope, as agonising as that hope may be, it's still there.
And as unlikely a situation as finding someone, however the likely the events that led up to it, it's just that gap. And it's that physical part of death, I guess. Like my grandfather. I was there. I watched him pass away. And as morbid as that sounds, that simple thing in itself, someone passing away, not necessarily before your eyes, because I mean, I've lost people in other ways before, but they're there and then they're not. And then you have a funeral, you bury them, there's a process, and you grieve. But missing persons, there's just no, you might have a report and someone saying, yep, this is what I think happened, but do you ever really know? Well, the answer is no, not ever.
Exactly. That's why you can't properly grieve, and it just continues. And I'm not sure if you imagine the day, or if you still have those types of dreams, that Ricky Lake dream. I love that, by the way. That's so relatable. Like, because there is that, always that spark, like maybe, like what a crazy story. But there were some pretty crazy stories on Ricky Lake, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. So
could have happened.
Yeah.
Do you still have visions like that? Do you think about the day of, you know, maybe being reunited with your dad, or is that a dream that you still have occasionally?
I think I'm old enough and wise enough now to probably, yeah, you know, maybe that was a childhood way to view things. But yeah, I do often, I do sometimes still have that dream, as weird as it sounds. But I mean, there's so many other dreams I have too that don't make any sense. But yeah, I mean, 99.999999% knows. And it's that incremental percent that'll come back to you at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you just think about that one thing. Well, what if?
And it's weird because hope does change over time. So what you're hoping for, like initially in my experience and with families that I work with, it's the hope in the beginning is that they're just going to walk back through the door, or they're going to be found, or they're going to be like with an Indonesian fishing group and it's all going to work out. And then once it becomes longer term, you know, you hope for resolution. But then with that, if you think about it rationally, it may be that it's remains. And so that's a very different and more morbid visual to have. But with that, there's resolution, but it's also the end of hope. So it's this strange kind of concoction of feelings of like dread. Like I used to dread getting that phone call, but also at the same time, hope for it. It's a very strange position to be in.
Yeah. And I think I remember, I don't know who said it or even if I said it, but you know, you don't know whether to hold out hope that they're going to come home or whether to grieve for them. And I think that in itself is exactly where families of missing persons are. One day they might grieve for what they've lost, but then they'll catch themselves and go, but if I've forgotten, if I'm not hoping that they're coming home, well, who am I? How can I think that way? Because if I think of them as gone, then they're gone.
And you've given up on them.
And you've given up. And if you've given up, then maybe that means you didn't love them or whatever the case
exactly.
may be.
And or the guilt.
Yeah, the guilt. If the moment you start grieving for them, is that the moment that they're gone? And I think that's what happened when I was 15 or 16. You know, maybe up until that point, I'd never actually said, he's gone. And I think that all just came crashing down as a 15-year-old. And, yeah, once hope is gone, what else do you have?
Gosh, I'm so sorry that this has happened to you. Do you know how, when your dad went missing, how that affected your Uncle Andy? Do you know what his response to that was?
Yeah, the Grahams typically aren't very open people. I don't know if that's a Scottish thing.
It's a Scottish thing,
yeah. Yeah, okay. So I don't know. I don't know. I know he was very spiritual. I know he liked kung fu. I know he believed in what he was doing as a social worker. So in helping people, providing support, I don't know, maybe it pushed him into that, like me, trying to resolve things, trying to push all of that energy, the energy it takes to stop yourself from grieving someone when they're missing and to maybe just turn it all into something with purpose. I don't know. Maybe that's why he turned to social work. Maybe that's why he turned to Buddhism. Maybe he was trying to seek to understand it himself. I mean, I don't know. He never physically said to me, you know, X, Y, Z, this is why I do what I do. But yeah, maybe. Maybe that's why he went the direction or the path that he went. And he found a lot of comfort in sort of being overseas. He worked with quite a few villages over in Thailand, somewhere over there, Cambodia maybe. So yeah, I think maybe he wanted to see meaning in all of it by supporting others perhaps.
I mean, undoubtedly these things have an impact and, you know, the way they manifest in your life, it's always going to be different for every one that's affected. But do you think it's affected the way that you live your life and maybe the way that you parent? You've got three kids. Do you think that having had these experiences has made you a certain way with them?
Having delved into, so studying social work and doing a handful of psychology subjects and reading about grief, and there's even a couple of counselling subjects, and I do look at the way I do things, I'm very reluctant to accept change, even just something simple at work. I mean, I'm supposed to be a flexible and adaptive and all that sort of thing, but even something simple about changing my day, it can be overwhelming. And I think maybe that does trigger something in me, because Wednesday morning I was driving my car and my mum calls me and tells me my uncle's missing. So, and I mean, that can happen with anyone passing away, but it changes in the blink of an eye. So I think, yeah, it's shaped me in a way that when something changes immediately, I get very anxious. Having said that though, I feel like I'm a very resilient type of person. So while things may change, I've learned that sometimes you just can't fight that change, and whatever will be, will be. And I have been through a lot, and that's okay.
Do you think that you've been made a bit more protective as a parent because of this? Like, you know, taking them for a beach holiday or letting them stay over at friends? Are you more conscious of the dangers?
We got offered to go out on a boat. And I was very reluctant to have my kids go on that boat. I mean, it was just inshore, but just that single thought. Like for a period of time, I was like, oh, yeah, that's okay. And then just got to it and I was like, actually, no, I'm not okay with this. So, yeah, maybe in a way.
There's a question that I used to always get asked when Dan was still missing that I always hated because, I mean, people are naturally curious about this topic and I understand that there's a lot of intrigue and drama and emotion and people have questions. Have you been asked in regards to Andrew especially, what do you think has happened? So with your dad, like I said, it was relatively, the situation was made clear to you by the people who were with him when he went missing. But with Andrew, he was alone. So there are more unknowns. And do you have a sense of what's happened?
Knowing Andrew, I think he would have gone into the water. I feel like that's probably the most likely scenario is that he took the snorkel and fins from the car and decided that he wanted to check out the furthest part of the beach. And Andrew being Andrew, in the sense that he was fit, healthy, he would have thought he was fine. And when we heard about the unusual swell on that day, oh, well, it all makes sense. What doesn't make sense for me is that I don't understand geographically how it all lays out, but I struggle to comprehend how he went from being on the rock wall to gone. I just feel like he was a fit, healthy young man. How did that happen?
So do you feel like it might be beneficial to, do you think you will go out there one day and try and see for yourself?
I feel like that's a way to, yeah, physically rationalize it, to sort of stand there and go, oh, yeah, I see now. Because until you're standing there, until you physically see it, yeah, I guess a bit like with Dad, they were hit with a wave. There's kind of only one place you can go. 1 + 1 = 2 in a way. But with Andrew, yeah, it's hard to comprehend without physically having been there. I mean, you can assume, but yeah. I do think I'll go there one day, whether or not it achieves anything. Who knows?
You've been in this realm now for 25 years. It's a very long time. And you said earlier that you feel like there's been a change in that period in regards to the way that society acknowledges this issue and how we talk about it, how we handle it. Going forward, what do you really want to see improved in the space of missingness?
I think from the moment someone goes missing, perhaps it would be helpful. I mean, I'm not saying this in a way that in any way denigrates what a police officer does. But I feel like the police are there, because I mean, that, to be honest, they're the first people you deal with. For Andrew, it was the AFP. They're there to do policing things. They're not there to support you. They're not there for you to lean on. They're not there for you to call at 1 a.m. in the morning because you've woken up from a dream where you're floating in the middle of the ocean in the dark and you don't know how to understand that. So I think it's important when you're in that space, not even just the first day, the first week, the first year, that first birthday, there should be support there. And having starting into this social work space, it's so important to support people who are grieving. no matter what the type of grief that is. So I think that first day, there should be a face, a name that says to you, I understand and I'm here no matter what. And no matter what happens, I'm going to be here after that. And I can make those phone calls for you and I can tell you how to close that bank account. I can tell you how to navigate all of this because you have to process all of this and all of the other stuff. You know, that's my grandma, an 80-something-year-old lady, had to front up to a tribunal just to be able to access Andrew's bank accounts. Like, you know, it's something an 80-year-old lady shouldn't have to do. And my mum, bless her, she tried to take that burden as much as she could, but they're missing. They're not dead. Where's your death certificate? We can't do anything about this, you know? So if I could have a wish list of what families of missing persons should have, it's support. It's simple. But I know, it's not that simple.
It's pretty complex, yeah. Yeah. There are just so many ways in which families need to be supported. There is that practical administrative side of things that needs guidance from the very beginning because there's a lot of admin on top of the emotional trauma and the psychological impact and all of that. There's just so much going on. So we'll hopefully be getting there in the next 25 years, but it is really complex. It's kind of one of those issues where people do assume that police just take care of it because the association, at least here in Australia, is that, you know, missing persons and police go hand in hand and police look for them and police find them and police deal with the families. And it's not always the case. It's, you know, often that police are under-resourced and the case isn't suspicious. So it's a grey area, which makes it even harder to navigate.
Yeah. And I think then when you do go and seek support, like if you go see a counsellor or, you know, I've seen psychologists before and you explain to them the situation, as a helping profession, they've got nothing to say. And I know their job is to listen, but, you know, even just that side of things and sort of delving into social work and all the rest of it, there is no framework, you know, and that just boggles my mind because missing persons is not a new thing. This has been around for...
ever.
Ever.
Mm-hmm.
How can we have missed this? And to finally put a name to the type of grief that, you know, that ambiguous loss, I asked my psychologist that. She had no, she sort of just looked at me blankly like, oh yeah, in a psychologist way. But yeah, even just that simple thing, you know, when people do seek support, they're counseled via grief counseling. Well, it is grief, but it's kind of not.
Not standard grief.
No.
No.
Because I think with psychology frameworks and social work frameworks and counselling frameworks, it's almost cyclical. But I think with missing persons, I kind of liken it to a more like a spiral that kind of goes back in on itself. Yeah, it's a circle, but it doesn't end. It just keeps going and going and going.
I'm very glad to be able to tell you that there is a framework that Dr. Sarah Wayland has created in the last 6 to 12 months. And so she is going to be heading up this pilot program that we're about to start where we do train Australian mental health care practitioners in ambiguous loss so that they know how to handle people like you.
Yes, I'm all over that. Yep, I know Dr. Wayland,
yeah,
not personally.
She's brilliant. Yes. And so we are going to start this pilot very shortly and hopefully in the not too distant future Australian psychologists and counsellors will have a grasp on it, because it is complex, but it's about time. Like, you're right, this is not a new concept. People have always gone missing, and I think the impact that it's had on the families and friends left behind, that's the new thing, because now we have platforms for it. We have social media, and that's really aided a lot of the projects that we've been doing in the last 7 years, but we're getting there slowly but surely.
Yeah, no, it's a step in the right direction. And for me, in wanting to do social work, it's like a dream come true, I guess you could say, because it's so important to me to put all of this to some sort of use. And I think maybe that's how some people do work through this, to put all that energy. Maybe that's why Andrew did what he did. Not necessarily with missing persons, but, you know, he understood in a way to help people, to put it to good use. I think that helps.
Absolutely, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Well, Jen, thank you so much for coming in and sharing all of that. It's going to resonate with a lot of people, so we're very grateful.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jen now sails with her brother Simon in Townsville. They regularly took out smaller yachts, but now they have graduated to a big yacht. They plan to complete the Sydney to Hobart yacht race in memory of David and Andrew and of the many people who go missing in Australia.
I actually went down to our yacht club and said, look, this is my plan. I want to do Sydney to Hobart. Where do I start? They just kind of looked at me and were like, are you insane? Sydney to Hobart? And you've never sailed before? And I was like, nah, I've sailed a bit. So yeah, they put us in touch with an owner of a yacht and he was looking for crew and we started doing races for him.
They still need to find a skipper willing to take them as ballast for the big race, but they hope to complete it one day. Although Jen is still a little scared of the sea.
To a certain extent, yeah, I think I am. When I see the coastline, I feel a little bit more secure. I think we've got more reason to think about the dangers of sailing than anyone. You know, I actually still, to this day, cannot eat seafood. As a kid, I didn't want to eat seafood because that's where my dad went, in the ocean. I'm not eating that, I would say. God, that might have eaten my dad, no thanks. Even though it's really impossible. But yeah, I don't want to eat seafood. I never want to try it.
At the same time, the ocean is a powerful connection to her father.
I don't have a lot of memories of my dad, if any. Even looking at his photo, I don't know him as well as I feel I should. When we go out in the water, you're sailing out there and there's quite a lot of opportunities when you're just on the same course, sailing in a straight line basically, and all you can do is sit there. And you're just thinking about everything, anything, nothing, whatever. And it's almost like you can imagine him sitting there next to you. I don't get that connection any other time except when I'm out sailing. And it feels like it means something. You know, maybe that's the type of feeling people get when they sit by a grave, when they sit by a headstone, when they have a place to go. Our place is the ocean. It's quite an expansive place to remember him, I guess. Sailing down the Derwent into Hobart, I don't know what that feeling's going to be like, but I hope it gives me some sort of connection to him. I don't know if ever one day we'll go to Winifred Beach, if that's a thing we want to do as a family. My grandma, we asked her about that. We said, do you want to go to Christmas Island? She said, no, it doesn't change anything. And I think for her, that's true. I think one day I might go to Christmas Island. And just to be there, I think it might be the same, that same feeling. Because where else can you go when someone's missing? The last place that they were.
David and Andrew Graham's episode was adapted from original writing by Robin McMicking. Missing Persons Advocacy Network is an unfunded charity run by me, Lauren O'Keefe. In 2016, we started a project that paired authors and artists with Australian families to tell their stories, to humanise missing loved ones beyond the stats they're typically reduced to. Though it grew to comprise murals, songs, sculptures, documentaries and coffee cups, our modern take on the old milk carton campaigns of the 80s, it began with a book called Two Short Stories. The What's Missing podcast was inspired by that book. These stories are but some of thousands. Help us help the usually unseen, unheard, forgotten community of those left behind by heading to our website where you can donate or get involved. mpan.com.au. That's mpan.com.au. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter using the same handle, mpanaus. That's mpanaus. If you have a missing loved one, check out our guide at missingpersonsguide.com.